No condemnation, now I dread. I mean, those are great words in that song, written by Wesley. Last Sunday, we were not in the book of Acts because George Bowes, one of our elders, brought the morning message. And by the way, it was an excellent message. If you were not here, I'd remind you that you can get all of our messages on our website. So I'd encourage you to go and listen to the message he brought last week from one of the Psalms. The reason why I asked George to preach last week was that I had a full week. Some of you recall that I was away most of the week attending a Board of Regents meeting for Trinity International University. It was down in Fort Lauderdale. And all the Board of Regents were staying in the Hyatt down there. And I was doing what I usually do when I'm away and I stay in a hotel overnight. I usually watch the news, you know, some for a bit. And then even though I know my phone can wake me up, for some reason I don't trust that I can do it right. So I always call downstairs and ask for a wake-up call, which I did on that occasion, as I've always done. And I asked for them to call me at 6 o'clock. I found that always works, you know, pretty well. I don't have to think about it. They'll call and wake me up. So the phone rang, and I'm not one of those guys who's real sluggish when he gets up. When the alarm goes off, I mean, I'm just awake. And so I got up, and I shaved, and I showered, and I got dressed. I put my contacts in. I went to put on my watch, and I thought, oh, gosh, my watch stopped. It says 1:45. And so I tapped it, and I thought, well, the battery was dead. And I looked over at the clock by the bedside, and it said 1:45. I am standing there fully dressed, shaved with my contacts, and it's 1:45 in the morning. For some reason, and they don't understand downstairs, my phone just rang in the middle of the night. And so I needlessly got up, and so of course, my wife said, well, what did you do? So I took my clothes back off, took my contacts back out. They're supposed to soak for so many hours. So I got back in bed and slept another 3.5 hours and then got up and kind of did it all over again. So anyway, I don't know why I'm telling you that. I feel like such a doofus. But but one of the things I saw on the TV before I turned it off, and this has been pretty much on the TV almost any night ever since what was called the Arab Spring, was, you know, they're covering riots somewhere. And that night it happened to be the riots that are taking place in Greece because of the financial crisis that they're facing and these austerity measures that they're taking, and the population is really quite upset about it. And the last time we were in the book of Acts, we left studying Acts chapter 21 in the middle of a riot. And so we want to go back to that riot now that has been incited by the Apostle Paul's presence in Jerusalem. And it's in Acts 21, so I ask you all to please turn now to Acts chapter 21. As I just intimated, the fuse that was lit that sparked this riot was the presence of Paul himself. And he was being unfairly and incorrectly accused of having taken a Gentile into the area of the temple where they were not allowed. He had not done that, but you know how rumors go. And when you have a huge mob, how things can get out of control very quickly. We're not going to rehearse that entire incident, but if you look just at verses 30 and 31, we see the climax of it. And all the city was aroused, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. And while they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. And even though, as it says in verse 36, that their screams continued, away with him, which meant don't just take him out of our sight, but away with him like permanently. Despite that, Paul was eager to stand up for Jesus and for the gospel of Jesus Christ. In fact, the outline that's on the back of your bulletin there for today, as I said, covers a larger section than usual because it covers over 5 chapters. If you've held on to your outline of the whole book of Acts, basically we're talking about Roman numeral 8, Paul's arrest in Jerusalem, and it covers this entire segment of Scripture. Now, this portion of Luke's historical account hangs together well, and that's why I've taken all of these chapters together, because it reveals a clear pattern of Paul standing up for Jesus in every situation, no matter what the audience, whether it be Jew or Gentile, whether it be the religious establishment of the Jewish Sanhedrin or whether it be government governing officials, such as a couple of governors and even a king. We find he is faithful to stand for Christ. And if I hope you remember many things I say today, but if you leave with any one thought that lingers with you through the whole week, I hope the thought you'll remember is the title I've given to this message, that when we kneel before God, we can stand before any man. That was Paul's conviction, and that's why he was so bold in standing up for Jesus first before the crowd, all the people that were amassed there that were rioting against him. I'd like to begin reading at verse 37, and you follow along as I read down just to the first couple of verses of chapter 22. So he's being rescued by this Roman, this group of Roman soldiers. Verse 37, "And as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, 'May I say something to you?' And he said, 'Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?' But Paul said, 'I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people.' And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, 'Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you.' And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And he said," verse 3, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. And I persecuted this way," capital W. And then he proceeds from that point on to pretty much share with the crowd his conversion experience that we looked at rather closely back in Acts chapter 9, his road to Damascus experience when Jesus appeared to Paul personally. And so he relates all of those events. Now his testimony about his conversion before the crowd. Where should I go to find them? To the very end? Okay. Okay. Now, I apologize for a couple of these pictures. I should have done a better job of finding better resolution on them, but I found four that I liked, and so I sent them to Dan, and he informed me that some of them were not the best. Kind of give you a sense of the setting here. Any of you who've been to Jerusalem probably have been to this place. This is a scale model, a strictly to scale model of the city of Jerusalem during the first century. Some Hebrew scholars and archaeologists, having scoured all of the information they could find in historical records and through all of excavations, have recreated the city. To give you an idea of the scale, those are people standing in the back there in those kind of blue shirts. So those are individuals, and that gives you a sense of the size of this model. And it's fascinating to walk around it and to identify some of these main buildings that we read about in the New Testament. When I studied in Israel one summer for a month, went here a couple of different times, I understand that there's something similar in Orlando at the Holy Land experience. I've not been there. Is it as big as this model? Okay. Did you see this one when you were in Jerusalem? So you've seen both of them. Okay. Well, you'll be seeing it again, and I don't know if I'm standing in anyone's way. You can see these four towers here. This is actually the fortress where the Roman soldiers are going to escort Paul to that place. But I'm jumping ahead a little bit. This is the temple area, and that taller building in the middle that looks kind of light blue would be the Holy of Holies. And this is Solomon's portico, where all these columns are. We've read about them gathering there several times in our study of Acts so far. But Antonius's fortress is right next door to the Jewish temple. Now, this is the one I have to apologize for. It's a little fuzzy. You can see those columns of the temple right there, and here's the fortress right here. Can you tell there's a ramp there? Or I don't know if you can tell that. There's like an incline, a ramp in the entrance right here. It perhaps shows up a little better there. It's right there. This is where the soldier would have lingered with Paul when he said, "Can I address the crowd?" So he probably was standing there. And I guess to get back to where I need to be, I just need to go backwards the other way as fast as I can. Okay. Whoops. I apologize for this, folks. Okay. So he asked to address the crowd. And, of course, there's a case of mistaken identity here. For some reason, this Roman soldier thinks that Paul is somebody else. And he says, "Are you that Egyptian?" Well, what he's referring to is that about 3 years earlier, there did show up in Jerusalem a man who was claiming to be a prophet. And he had a large band of followers. And he led them out into the wilderness. And there were really about, as the text says, 4,000 of them. And then he led them all back into the city, and they sort of camped out at the Mount of Olives, and they were preparing to really attack Jerusalem to bring about the messianic overthrow of the current Jewish leaders as well as Romans. And most people considered him a charlatan, but everybody remembered him because of the size group he had with him. And so this Roman just assumed this must be that guy. Who else could be upsetting this many people? And Governor Felix, that we're going to read about in just a few moments, sent troops and drove this guy off. Well, Paul makes it clear that he was not that rebel rouser, and the Roman gives him permission to address the crowd. And he speaks Hebrew, which makes quite an impression. And it's not that it's that impressive that a Jewish man who used to be a Pharisee speaks Hebrew, but because they weren't sure who he was. There was just this guy who's caused all this trouble that they heard that as the rumor went through the crowd. And so as he begins to speak in Hebrew, it says they became very, very quiet and very attentive. And no surprise, when we speak people's native tongue, it has a way of communicating unlike any other language, even if they know other languages. That's why it's always been so significant for groups like Wycliffe Bible Translators to go into areas and translate the scripture into the heart language of the peoples that they're trying to share the gospel with. You can certainly, if you know several languages, hear the gospel in other languages. Maybe some of you are multilingual and you have several Bibles in several different foreign languages. But the fact is, it's your mother tongue. One that people would call one's heart language. I know when I was studying in Germany a few years ago in Wittenberg, our Reformation course started off in Prague. We looked at John Huss and that part of the Reformation before we landed in Wittenberg for about 4 weeks. And I became really good friends with a guy who's on staff with Campus Crusade. He's been serving in China for about 15 years. And of course, in his newsletters, he says he's an Asian country. I'm not even going to give you his name, but we became pretty good friends, and so he's fluent in Mandarin Chinese. So we were standing having a sausage in the town square of Prague, and this Chinese couple came by, and they ordered one. He turned to them and just spoke to them in their language. I mean, their eyes got like that big, and they were stunned. They just seemed thrilled that somebody spoke Chinese. He stood there for about 15 minutes, and I just stood there looking on and as he conversed with them. But you speak someone's language, and it really has a way of cutting to the heart of things. And so he's speaking his native tongue, Hebrew, and he has a very, for the moment, captive audience. But let your eye glance down to verse 21 of chapter 22. This is after he's given his conversion story to the crowd. Verse 21, he quotes the words he heard from Jesus, and he said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." Verse 22, and they listened to him up to this statement. And then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, the military commander steps in. So here they're listening very attentively to everything he's got to say up till that statement. And as soon as he mentioned Gentiles, they actually lose it. They go berserk. And so the soldier takes him into the barracks just to save his life. And so in verses 24 to 30 of chapter 22, could we just read a few more verses here with me, starting in verse 24, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging, so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. And when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And when the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? For this man is a Roman. And the commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And he said, yes. And the commander answered, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money. And Paul said, but I was actually born a citizen. Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains. Verse 30, but on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them. So this Roman soldier's thinking, you know, for a guy to get a crowd this angry, he must be doing something wrong. We've got to find out what it is. So he decides he's going to submit Paul to interrogation by scourging. And then Paul drops what becomes a bombshell of a question to those who are about to take out the whip with the several strands of leather with bits of bone and metal in it to beat someone's back. Paul asks a question that stops them dead in their tracks. And in fact, you notice in verse 29, two words stand out. When he hears that Paul's a Roman citizen, he releases him immediately, and that also he's afraid. You might wonder, well, how do they know he's not lying? Maybe he's just pulling out the trump card, I'm a Roman citizen, just to escape, you know, getting whipped there in the moment. One did not lie about one's Roman citizenship. Because to falsely claim to be a Roman citizen and then be proven not to be, the penalty was death. And you didn't carry those kinds of documents around. I mean, we have identification cards and papers and things like that, and we have little passports that get us almost into any country of the world. But you didn't carry those kinds of things in that day. Basically, the documentation were kept in family archives someplace in a safe place. But one thing that was a part of Roman law is that Roman citizens were exempt from examination under torture. They were never to be flogged. An uncondemned person who was a Roman citizen was to never be subjected to this kind of treatment. And there are examples. In fact, about 60 years before this incident with Paul, there was a city in Asia Minor that flogged and executed some Roman citizens in error. The emperor at the time, Augustus, had the entire city enslaved because of that action. Just about 10 years before this incident, the island of Rhodes dared to crucify some Roman citizens, and Emperor Claudius was so irate that he annexed the entire island in retaliation. You just didn't flog a Roman citizen, and also you didn't falsely claim to be a citizen. You know, this idea of protecting your citizens, this is something that has carried forth from the Romans through much of history for many nations of the world. In fact, I came across a very interesting quote from a prime minister of England back in the middle of the 1800s. And this was his statement. As the Roman in days of old held himself free from indignity when he could say in Latin, I am a Roman citizen, so also a British subject in whatever land he may be shall feel confident that the watchful eye and the strong arm of England will protect him against injustice and wrong. And just because you're a citizen of a country living somewhere else doesn't mean you don't enjoy all the privileges of that citizenship. And it was certainly true for the Romans. So the commander was understandably feeling a little antsy and uneasy, if not on the verge of an anxiety attack. And while the commander volunteered that he had purchased his citizenship, I think expecting that maybe Paul was going to say, well, I did too. Paul said, no, he was actually born a citizen. How did this come about? We just simply don't know. Obviously, if he was born a citizen, it meant that Paul's father was a Roman citizen. Cilicia was a very wealthy city. Perhaps Paul's father was a wealthy man who had done some great service for the state, and so he was awarded citizenship. Or perhaps just from his personal wealth, he was able to purchase it. Regardless of how that came about, it was such that Paul was born a citizen of the Roman Empire. But what an example Paul is here. I mean, can you imagine? They've been screaming, kill him. And he's being escorted off, and he stops and says, I want to address the crowd. And I think I would have wanted to get away from that crowd as soon as I could. But this is typical of Paul, isn't it? I'd like to continue at a fast pace. I know we're kind of flying like a drone here. I mean, we're kind of at higher altitude and just zeroing in on certain passages. But follow along as I read the first 11 verses of chapter 23. And Paul, looking intently at the council, said, Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. And do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck? But the bystanders said, Do you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. But perceiving that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. And as he said this, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there arose a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. So here we have him standing for Jesus once again, but this time before the religious establishment. That's what the Sanhedrin represents. And I believe it's an unintentional act of disrespect. I say that, and I've labeled it as such, but I'm acknowledging that I believe that because there are some Bible commentators who suggest that Paul was being sarcastic. You're the high priest? You know, that kind of thing. Somebody who would act that way. But I don't think that's the case. I think that he made this statement. Before I address this issue of whether he knew it was the high priest or not, let me interject this thought. When Paul begins to make his statement, you'll notice it said in the first verse of chapter 23 that he looked intently at this group of men. And he makes an opening statement, which seems fine in and of itself, but his opening statement that I have lived life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day is what provokes the high priest to give the orders to have him struck in the mouth. In fact, it wasn't just a good conscience. He said, I have a perfectly good conscience before God. Well, the high priest took that as the ultimate in arrogance and in blasphemy. How could Paul say that? We might even ask ourselves. Up to this day, he's just given his testimony. We know how he used to live and how he acted as a Pharisee. How could he say that when he had his own prior days of being a persecutor of believers? Well, Jesus intervened and showed Paul that he was wrong. But even in those days when he was persecuting the church, Paul believed he was acting in good faith and in good conscience as a good Jew. He believed with all of his heart that he was doing the right thing. So even though he may have been sincere, we know that he was sincerely wrong. And that's why Jesus personally appeared to him, and it took an appearance by Jesus to convince him of that. Much like followers of other religions. The followers of many other religions are quite devoted and quite sincere about what they believe. But they're sincerely wrong. In fact, remember when Paul wrote to the Philippians and he was giving somewhat of an autobiographical statement about himself, and he added this comment that he, in describing himself, said, "As to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless." He saw himself as a blameless person, as a Pharisaical Jew. He's rehearsing that before them, but that one statement brought about this rebuke from the high priest. Now, Paul has stated in the text he did not know that he was the high priest, and that he goes on to quote Exodus 22, saying, "If I'd have known that, I wouldn't have done that, because Scripture tells me I shouldn't do that." So why didn't Paul recognize Ananias? It seems like he'd be aware of who the high priest is amongst this, you know, distinguished group of men. Well, some people have observed that we know Paul had poor eyesight. He kind of acknowledges that in one or two places in his other letters. And perhaps as he was looking across the room, he just saw this person in a white robe, but just dimly perceived who they were. Perhaps that's what prompted him to say, "You whitewashed wall," just seeing a figure on the other side of the room wearing white. Remember, this council was quickly assembled. So it probably had more the feel of an informal meeting, and perhaps Ananias the high priest was not even wearing his normal formal attire, because this was a quickly called meeting. Also keep in mind that Paul has been away from Jerusalem for over 20 years. So it's been a long time since he's been there, and he probably did not even personally know Ananias, and so he would not have necessarily have recognized him. One thing about this misunderstanding and this confrontation is that it is clear that as bold as Paul is, Paul does not want to be disrespectful. And there is something that is instructive for us in that, that even when sometimes in debate and in presenting the gospel and sharing the gospel, we want to be sure that we speak the truth in love, that we do so respectfully. What is one of the things that's so complained about in the political arena today? People have been talking about it for years, that civility has disappeared in political debate. You know, and of course we know the mudslinging and the dirty ads and the campaigns and all that kind of thing that, you know, that goes on. As people have a hard time disagreeing in a respectful way. But when it comes to the gospel, yes, we find ourselves strongly disagreeing with people. But we want to be doing so respectfully. And it seems to me Paul, as much as acknowledges that was not my intention by quoting Exodus chapter 22. What was that? I thought it was almost silly, this debate that they just had last week. Perry and Romney. "You hired illegal aliens to work in your yard." "No, I've never hired." "Oh, yes, you did." Yeah. It almost sounded like the schoolyard to me. "Yes, you did." "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did." No, it's ridiculous to me. I won't go any further down that road. I felt, you know, with all the things going on in the world, that was a lot more important things than whether somebody had an illegal immigrant unknowingly working in their yard. Do you all know what I'm talking about? I mean, does it sound familiar? Okay. Everybody's staring at me like, what are you talking about? I want to say something else about Ananias too. For Ananias to command for this man to be struck in the mouth like that says something about the kind of person Ananias was. Ananias, from all of the other histories by Josephus and others that have been written, he was not well liked by Jewish people. He was characterized by his avarice and by his liberal use of violence. He was often confiscating tithes that were given to the ordinary priest and using it for himself. He often engaged in accepting bribes and in giving bribes from Jews as well as Romans. He kind of played both sides of the street. He was a brutal, scheming man, hated by the Jewish nationalists because he seemed so pro-Roman in a lot of his policies. In fact, when that final war with Rome broke out in AD 66 that concluded in AD 70 with the destruction of the temple, when that war broke out, the Jewish nationalists attacked Ananias' house and burned it to the ground. He had to flee to Herod's palace just to save his own life. And then he was forced to flee from Herod's palace. And interestingly enough, I did a double take when I read this. Interestingly enough, having just heard about Gaddafi being found hiding in a drainage pipe and finally drug out, and how he's died, we're still waiting to hear. But do you know that's exactly how Ananias died? He was on the run. He was hiding in an aqueduct, and they found him and they killed him. These were Jewish nationalists that found him. And so that's how Ananias ended up. And I must say, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for him because he was certainly a weasel of a character. Now, there's a diversionary tactic that's employed. I don't want to lead us astray by using the word diversionary here, but you heard what I read happened. He's before the council, and all of a sudden he brings up this issue that he's a Pharisee, and there were two major parties within Judaism, and they had some distinct theological differences, and one of them was belief in the supernatural and resurrection. And of course, Pharisees believed in it, and the Sadducees denied it. Well, Paul brought up that issue, and it created such a furor that they began arguing with each other that finally the Pharisees began to start to defend Paul. There's nothing wrong with this guy. Why? Because he's identified with their school of thought and where they are coming from. And, you know, some have suggested, in fact, if you notice the language that was used there in verses 6 to 11, there was a great uproar, great dissension. And the text tells us that the Roman commander was afraid that Paul was going to literally be torn to pieces if he didn't extricate Paul from that place. And so they pull him out again to save his life. It's interesting here, twice Paul's life has been saved by the secular governing authorities from his own brethren. But man, look at, in the midst of all of this tension and life-threatening circumstances, look how Jesus ministers to him in verse 11. The Lord comes to him the next night, and he has a vision of Jesus standing at his side, and he says, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome as well." As I was studying these passages, my study directed me to a verse in Isaiah. And I wonder if after Jesus said these very encouraging words to Paul, and Paul, knowing Isaiah as he did, didn't recall this verse. "No weapon that is formed against you shall prosper, and every tongue that accuses you in judgment you will condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord." That's Isaiah 54:17. And that seems to be the kind of promise that Jesus is reaffirming. Plus, doesn't this help bring some understanding to the debate we were looking at 2 weeks ago about whether Paul was disobeying the Lord to go to Jerusalem when it had been prophesied he'd be arrested? But remember, Paul had already stated he had a desire, and he believed it was a conviction from God, to take the gospel to Rome. Well, Jesus is here affirmed that you're going to be my witness in Rome as well. I'm not going to read verses 12 to 22 aloud to you, just to summarize them. The Jews are so angry, they are so livid, that the Roman soldiers have taken Paul out, that they conspire. In fact, the text tells us, Luke's very, very specific at this point, that 40 Jewish men conspired together to assassinate Paul. And so they went to the Jewish leaders and said, "Call for another council meeting tomorrow. And as he's being transported, we will descend upon him and we'll kill him." Now, I wish we knew more about this. We don't. Apparently, as the text tells us, and I'm summarizing, Paul has a sister. We know nothing else other than that. He's got a sister. She's got a son, Paul's nephew. Why Paul's nephew was in a position to learn of this plot, we don't know. Curiosity kills me. But somehow he did learn of it. So his nephew goes to where Paul is in jail, asks to talk to the soldier. First he talks to Paul, actually, and tells him, I've heard there's a plot to kill you. Paul says, you need to tell the guards this. So he ends up talking to the lead commander and says, there's 40 men, they're planning to kill him. And so what the commander does is during the middle of the night, he gets 200 men, 70 horsemen, and secretly whisks Paul away over to the city of Caesarea. And so here this assassination plot is foiled because of a nephew that learned about it. Now, the third group he stands up for Jesus before are the government officials. This starts in chapter 23, verse 23, and goes down through 26, 32. We can't finish all these verses today, but let me make a few summary comments with you. There are two governors that he appears before, Felix and Festus, and then there's one king, Agrippa. So he has three succeeding, but this takes a couple of years. In fact, I do want to read one more brief passage aloud to you. Would you follow along beginning in verse 23 of chapter 23? And this will repeat what I just summarized. And he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. And when these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So Caesarea is the provincial capital of Judea. That's where Governor Felix resides. He's an utterly ruthless governor in the way he was suppressing Jewish uprisings. In fact, the Roman historian Tacitus describes this governor this way. He exercised the power of a king with the mind of a slave. That was Tacitus's assessment of Felix. So this group comes down, and we'll get to this next week. Ananias comes, a group of the Jewish elders come, and they bring Tertullus, a lawyer, with them. Well, you know you're in trouble when they bring the lawyer. Sorry, Joel. But Paul responds to their accusations, saying he's not guilty, there's no evidence of this, but he does admit to one thing, and what he admits to in verse 14, but this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and what is written in the prophets, having a hope in God. And he goes on to explain his belief in the resurrection and of Christ. And so that much Paul is willing to admit to. But you know, it's so impressive to me, and I know that we have to keep in mind that God has enabled Paul, and he's given Paul this boldness, but I don't think we're excluded from that. I think that when we call on God, the Holy Spirit can give us boldness and give us courage in various situations. But we're talking about standing before powerful men who at just the turn of their hand can decide that you'll be put to death. The Jewish Sanhedrin had that ability, and certainly these Roman governors and this king have that ability. And yet Paul stands up, undaunted by the power and the authority by which he is being confronted, and speaks the truth. Some of you know Danny and Margaret Lynch. They've been friends of mine for about 25 years. Most of those years they've spent on staff with Campus Crusade in East Africa and various countries. And just about 2 years ago, they returned to the United States, and they work in conjunction with the Christian Embassy in Washington, D.C. It's a ministry of Campus Crusade working with government officials and diplomats. And I just learned from them not too long ago about a particular incident where there was a military general who had just gotten serious about living out his faith. And immediately when he made that decision, found that he was tested about his boldness to stand for the Lord Jesus, because he had been asked to participate as a panel member with other military staff and judge advocates, and it was a professional development seminar for military lawyers. So he was a part of this panel. Of course, they covered many different issues. But then near the end of the seminar, each panel member was asked, what book would you recommend to be read? Just pick a book. And the way this general explains it, that his first thought was the Bible. But then he started thinking about, I'm a general, I'm in a military uniform, I've got all these other judge advocates, you know, and with this crowd, he started to second guess himself whether he should admit that the Bible is the one book that he would recommend. So he started to try to think of another book. But as he mulled it over and as his turn was coming, he was asked the question, General, your answer. And he said, I recommend reading the Bible. And then he went on and gave this brief explanation. Quote, the Bible provides history, poetry, inspiration, faith, and guidelines on how to live. When he finished making that statement, there was dead silence, and the moderator called the meeting to an end. And the general wasn't sure what to make of that. And so when the meeting was over, he walked out of the room, and he saw a line of officers waiting for him. And as he walked up, they each, one by one, shook his hand and thanked him for making that statement. He went on to say that he felt like a celebrity in the way they seemed to express such appreciation. And there's a lot of wonderful things going on in Washington, D.C. for the gospel. In fact, just in the Pentagon alone, I've read that there are probably 14 different Bible studies going on with at least 70 people meeting weekly just in the Pentagon. And so it's encouraging to know that in places like that where people make decisions and people who are in positions of power and influence, that the gospel is. But it takes people like that general to be bold enough in that kind of a setting. And has not the Apostle Paul given us that kind of an example and that kind of an impetus? So, standing up for Jesus, why do we not stand up for Jesus? Why do we not? We could be afraid of rejection. We could be intimidated by the prospect of ridicule. The general, I think, struggled with that a bit in those moments. Perhaps we feel insecure how to answer hard questions. Is it possible that we don't stand up for Jesus because we don't love and care enough about people who don't know him? I want to conclude by asking ourselves, I'm going to ask you as I ask myself this question. Are there people who know you who do not know that you're a follower of Jesus Christ? Are there people who know you who do not know you are a follower of Jesus Christ? And if so, why is that the case? Let's pray.